Welcome to the Jess Cagle Podcast with Julia Cunningham. Each week, Jess and Julia sit down with Hollywood's biggest names to discuss their current projects and take a trip down memory lane as they dive deep into their classic catalogs. SiriusXM presents the Jess Cagle Podcast with Julia Cunningham. Now, here are your hosts, Jess and Julia.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to a very special SiriusXM Town Hall with the stars and the writer, producer, that seems like an understatement, the kingpin of many Saints of Newark, which is out tomorrow in theaters and on HBO Max. And we have been waiting a very, very long time for this, obviously. It's a sequel to The Sopranos, to The Sopranos. Here with us, we have the stars of the film, Michael Gandolfini, Leslie Odom Jr., Alessandro Nivola, and again, writer, producer, kingpin, creator, David Chase. Welcome, everybody. Hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Hello.
It's great to have you here. Julia Cunningham and I are very, very excited to talk to you. We're going to start with David. David Chase, I guess first things first, why was it that you wanted to do this prequel? Is this something that had been kicking around in your head ever since the show went off the air or even during the show?
No, it was not. I wasn't interested in doing any kind of a Sopranos prequel, sequel, whatever, after the show went off the air. But after, I forget how many years, I found myself missing it a little bit. I missed those characters. I enjoyed writing them. And also, I had written a bunch of things that were bogged down in various problems. And so I thought, it was time that I did something which had a better than average chance of getting shot. And so that Sopranos was it.
The actual, you know, body of the Many Saints of Newark set in the 60s and 70s, as we know, a prequel. And, you know, we assume, I think, when everyone jumps to it, think, oh, God, Tony Soprano. But it's really Tony Soprano adjacent, right? It really stems from the Moltisanto family and Dickie specifically. So, Alessandro, I wanted to hear if you would break down the story a little bit and tell us how it centers around your character.
Moltisanti.
Moltisanti. The many saints, literally. Yeah.
Plural version. And for those of you who don't know, Molti means many and Santi means saints, which every day somebody texts me on social media saying, like, you know, that they've had this huge epiphany. I don't know if David knew that it was going to be a secret to most people, but they're coming around.
That's a real name, by the way. I didn't make that up.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
I didn't put Molti and Santi together.
No. I mean, I'm sure most of the characters are real names, even though there's a humor to the translations. That's true of a lot of Italian names that I know. In any case, Dickie was Christopher Moltisanti's dad, who was the character played brilliantly by Michael Imperioli in the series. And he was really the guy who had been a surrogate father figure to Tony in his youth when his parents were checked out for one reason or another. His dad was in prison all the time and his mom was nuts. So this was the one person in the neighborhood who really took an interest in him and believed in him. And unfortunately for Tony, he may not have been the ideal role model.
David, what was it about this? I mean, there are so many years and small eras that you could have focused on. This is obviously set in, you know, the 60s and 70s in Newark. And a lot of it has to do with the Newark rights, which were the 1967 race rights in Newark. Why focus in on that particular event?
Well, I think, if I remember right, it was a long time ago. That's where the Sopranos, the DeMeo family, did their work and had their control. It was Newark, New Jersey. And so that's where you would set any prequel. If you're going to do that, then let's see, what would be interesting? What is Newark famous for? Oh, yeah, the riots. It was that particular spark, I think, that just sort of started it off. But my co-writer and myself, Lawrence Connor, were youths during that time. And I would say extremely leftist, radical in our thinking. I'm still, in some ways, probably are. And we thought it was a story worth telling. I think we thought that maybe a lot of younger people, especially black people, didn't know about the riots. And we proved to be correct. And we felt that they should know about them.
And Leslie, you play Harold McBrayer. Obviously, this time is an incredibly seminal moment for him. He's a new character. He's the one that we're really being introduced to for the first time. Tell us who Harold is and how he comes into play.
On the page, Harold reminded me a lot of my grandfather, who's a part of the Great Migration, as Harold would have been. You know, some 6 million black people moved up from the South to the North between 1910 to about 1970, looking to divorce themselves from a plantation economy, looking to get a good factory job and create a better life for themselves and for their children. Looking also to separate themselves from a certain kind of oppression. Of course, we find a new kind of oppression in the North and in the West, but you know, not quite the same. And so in those ways, Harold reminded me of Linnell. And once they get to the North, the paths they take are very different. My grandfather did find his way to one of those good factory jobs and worked there for 3 decades. And Harold chooses to work for the family. So once they get there, what they do is very different. But I thought that the impetus, why they would have left, you know, the kind of the circumstances that created those men, you know, my grandfather and Harold, you know, was similar. And in that way, when I watch the film and I see a little piece of him up there, it's very meaningful to me.
And Michael, you have to take on the beast of the role that is Tony Soprano, of course, you know, a man that we love, even though we know, you know, this later story that he kills people, but is torn between his family, his work. You know, is he a good dad? Is he a good person? Why do we root for him? But you take on this character at a time when it could have gone either way. And so how did you tap into Tony as he was young? And tell us about who Tony Soprano was when he was young.
I think when I first read the script, I thought, wow, this he's so different. Tony's so good. But I think it's interesting. People expect Tony to be what, like a gun wielding gangster at 8 years old? Like, it's not a reality. So it's just, he's a boy, he's a teenager. And he wants to make his dad and his mom proud. He wants to make his uncle Dickie proud. And he's just sort of searching for any sort of kind of comfort or control or any sort of, you know, he just wants to be a good person. But I think he's torn between, you know, he's not even, I don't think he's even at the point of like, do I want to go into the mob? I don't think that's where his thinking is at. The thinking is, I mean, Tony even says at one point, like, what do you think they talk about in there? Like, he's just discovering what the mob really is and what they do. And he knows that there's violence, but he doesn't really know what they're doing. So he's just kind of a boy really growing up. And it's just a testament to David and Lawrence Connor, kind of their writing, you know, it was all on the page. And just to get to do it was such a gift. I mean, every day came with such sort of interesting and I feel like David's writing and Lawrence kind of, there's this really amazing balance where the character, in some ways, you understand them really in this sort of incredible way. You understand what the root of the scene is, but there's still room to sort of bring your own history. Leslie was talking about his, you know, grandfather. I know Alessandro looked into sort of his roots too. You can bring your own thing to it, but the gift is what David wrote. That's what's exciting and really kind of it's just right there.
I'm Jess Cagle here with Julia Cunningham, and we have a very special SiriusXM Town Hall with the writer, producer, I keep calling him Kingpin, of The Many Saints of Newark, David Chase, as well as the stars of the film, Alessandro Nivola, Leslie Odom Jr., Michael Gandolfini. The movie is out tomorrow in theaters and on HBO Max. We were just, Michael, I think the early reviews of the movie have really pointed out how brilliant your performance is, because it's not an impression of Tony Soprano at all, but you really capture the essence of him. You capture the innocence of him. How did you approach it? Obviously, you are intimately familiar with James Gandolfini, your father. But did you go back and did you capture part of him? Did you go back and watch old episodes of the show? Where did you find your inspiration for, you know, Tony Soprano as a teenager?
Yeah, I definitely went back, and I had never seen the show before auditioning, so I had to watch it for the first time. It's funny. I mean, most of us didn't. I mean, talking to Vera Farmiga didn't, Leslie didn't, Alessandro didn't, Samson, Big Pussy didn't. So
I'm seeing David react, and I'm like scared. Sorry, go on.
Somehow you guys managed to be a hit show without the five of us watching. I don't know how you guys did it.
That was how close we came.
So it was sort of one of the gifts of this was not only getting to work with everyone, it was becoming a fan of the show and learning about it so much. And then like all of my friends, my entire generation started watching it. So I got to talk to them about it and really analyze it in school and like all this amazing sort of thing. So it was a real gift to first become a fan and just be so proud of what, you know, you know, in some ways I consider the cast and the crew, you know, a second family in many ways. So just really was so proud of the accomplishments they did. And then, you know, I mean, regarding my dad, you know, I think my dad was an incredible actor and, you know, a good man, but, David created this character. So the roots and the way his triggers are and the way he sort of acts, it was all on the page. So I knew, you know, it was the same Tony because of David's writing and his, you know, his character. And then I just thought about, well, if I can create physically the mannerisms and how he uses his eyes and how he, you know, squints or uses his hands and his accent, if I did that, you would see the character that everyone knows and loves, and I'll have a little more room emotionally to sort of do whatever I wanted to do, something different. He can be different much more, but physically it'll still be the same guy. So that's sort of what I had thought while building this.
And David, for you, was Michael, either subconsciously or fully in the back of your mind when you were working on this, or was that something you had to come around to, the idea of like, oh, should we ask Michael or audition Michael? How did that process for you come forward?
No, he was not in the back of our minds when we were writing it at all. I don't happen to write when I write with any people pictured. Like, I don't write with actors and particular actors in mind. And we didn't come to Michael until we had had a couple of months, maybe, of sort of disappointing searches for young Tony. And at that point, I recalled that I had had a lunch with Michael about a year or two before, that he had just come from California. And he didn't seem very Tony Soprano-esque to me at that lunch. But I knew that he wanted to be an actor. I had heard that. So I said, well, we should try him out. And the strange, I don't know if it's strange, but Michael says there were three auditions, none of which I remember at all, but I was totally convinced it was going to work. And I maybe that's why I don't remember the auditions, because I didn't think they were important. That was, I just knew it was destiny of some kind.
Leslie, you said that when you went in, I think for your first meeting on this, that it was like going in for a meeting with the Marvel Cinematic Universe. There was so much secrecy. You had no idea what you were getting into. Can you tell me what that process was like?
Yeah, it's true. They told me very, very little. And sometimes as an actor, you know, as you can imagine, like, that gives you a little bit, you know, it gives you a little bit of a chip or something. It's like, you know, can you give me something, a character description, anything? But I couldn't deny, every time I picked up these scenes, I knew so little, but I couldn't deny that I was inspired. I was inspired by the words on the page. And so I just, I decided not to get in my own way and just continue to walk toward that inspiration. And somewhere around, yeah, the third or fourth audition, I got to meet David and Alan. And it felt like I had their confidence and their trust, even in that early meeting. And so I'm glad I didn't get in my own way.
Alessandro, some of the scenes that I loved were these weirdly quieter home scenes, actually, with Vera Farmiga, who plays Livia, the great mother of Tony Soprano, this iconic role who, you know, you step in as a pseudo father to Tony and you take him under your wing. You don't have a son early on in the film and, you know, want this boy to, you know, kind of have with you. And, you know, there are these great lines where you say to Livia, you know, oh, give your husband a break. He's been gone for 4 years. And she's like, he's been gone. I did 4 years. I mean, it's like classic, you know, hilarious David Chase writing, which I so love. But I also loved those dynamics of Dickie and her together, because you can see that she does see Dickie as a role model for Tony and a pseudo father. And I'm so curious about some of those home scenes that you shot and working with Vera specifically, because it did feel like a pseudo home structure in a way.
Yeah, well, one of the, you know, most important devices of the story is that everybody has Dickie totally wrong. And he doesn't reveal himself to anyone, except kind of accidentally to his uncle in prison, but he lies to him too. Livia is among the many people in his orbit who think that he's got life all figured out, and who are endlessly charmed and attracted to him. And know nothing about the way that he's, about what an emotional mess he is, and how much he's unraveling over the course of the story. And so there's a constant tension between the way that that everybody is responding to him and what's actually going on in his life, which only the audience is aware of. Obviously with Tony, you know, that's the reason for, you know, that's the big missed opportunity of David with Tony. I mean, of Dickie with Tony was to really reveal himself to Tony, because that would have changed everything. But in Livia's case, I think that she's kind of in love with Dickie. And they have a kind of flirtation. I mean, we had so few scenes together to you know, play around with that more. But in the moments that we had, I think she, you know, Dickie's somewhat aware of her affection for him and everything, and he kind of likes her too, and so they have a little bit of a flirtation, but at the same time he's like, you know, take it easy, like don't get too close, you know.
I've got enough going on, thank you. Yeah,
and that's partly in that scene why he's like trying to sort of, yeah, he wants her and Johnny to be okay, you know what I mean? Like he doesn't want to deal with, you know, another mess, you know. And so and also with where Tony's concerned is she's the one who keeps trying to encourage Dickie to step in Johnny's place as opposed to Junior or anyone else. And Dickie wants to he wants a son, and he wants Tony to be his son, but he doesn't want to have a relationship, a father-son relationship with him. He wants to have a friendship with him where he's not called upon to have any of the responsibilities of a parent, and instead he can just like have a great time together and be like the guy who comes in that Tony loves. And he doesn't want to have to, you know, discipline him or, you know, have Tony not like him because he's coming down on him for one thing or another. And that's like something that he's just like, it really depresses him to have to take on that responsibility. And in fact, if he had taken on that responsibility more, again, like, you know, Tony might have been put on a different path. But so in that scene with Livia, you know, she's asking him once again, I'm sure she's done this before, to, you know, step in Johnny's absence and try and like set this kid straight. And he's just like, oh God, you know, I don't want to have to be the guy that you know, goes and has to kind of, you know, do the boring shit of, you know, telling him to behave himself. So that scene has all those things going on, you know, her, they're kind of like little, you know, vague sexual tension or whatever, him sort of trying to, you know, be sweet to her but not let it get too intense that way. And then to avoid having to do what he then goes and does, which is sit down and talk to Tony in his room. And by the way,
you are listening.
Vera, for me, like unbelievable. So I couldn't have enough scenes with her. I mean, I'd love some more in the future.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt, Alessandro. So you guys were not obsessive fans of the original Sopranos, but you must have seen people on the crew and other people working on the movie when they saw, you know, Billy Magnuson as, you know, and Corey Stoll playing younger versions of these iconic characters. You must have seen people just geek out and fall over. I mean, if I had seen Vera Farmiga as, you know, Livia, I would have fainted, as I did when I watched the movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, let me just qualify what you said. I, as far as my relationship to the show goes, you know, I was aware of the show being the thing that kind of ushered in this current era of cultural relevance for TV. I mean, you had to be living under a rock not to know that everything changed with that show, that was the moment where storytelling got so much more nuanced and complicated the introduction of the greatest anti-hero on TV ever, you know, all these things were, you know, like a cast of, you know, some of the most brilliant actors that television had. And so these were things that, you know, I was aware of before watching the show. I hadn't watched it because when the thing started airing, I was an out of work actor living in a little tiny studio apartment in on Christopher Street, and I didn't have cable. But I certainly by the time we just so you know when I watched it, by the time we were filming the thing, you think I hadn't watched the show before I started playing the part? Are you crazy? I watched the whole first season within a week of being sent the pages that I was being asked to audition for. So by the time I sent five scenes into David and Alan, I'd watched the whole first season. And then when they asked me to do the job, I watched the rest of them, you know, as much as I could consume in a day until I was done. So that's just to, you know, give you an idea of, like, you know, what a treat it was to come to the show, apart from being offered this kind of like career changing job that David, you know, so kindly, like, you know, plucked me for. And I mean, by the time I was on set, like, I'd lived with all these characters as much as anybody else had. And, you know, seeing those actors pull off what they pulled off, I mean, apart from the sort of, you know, humor of it and the thrill of it, and seeing kind of, you know, how strange it was to have, you know, see how they'd studied their behavior and physicality and everything. I was also just so impressed by how they managed to both do these impersonations of these well-loved characters, but also to imbue them with their own souls and to bring their own life to it. None of them were kind of, you know, SNL parodies of these characters. They all had their own inner life. And I was grateful that I wasn't saddled with having to do that the way that Michael did and Vera and everybody else, because, you know, that was a burden lifted for me, because I had kind of like carte blanche to invent this character just based on what David had given me in this script. But I couldn't believe the way that these other actors, you know, Michael in particular, but all of them managed to accomplish two things at once. You know, one was honoring the original incarnations of the character, and the other was to bring like performances that were alive and original and particularly their own.
To jump in, I mean, yeah, like, it's not to say, like, by the time I had gotten the audition, I watched the first season, and then when you know, the role came around, I watched the full first season, full show, like Alessandra, and then, you know, I really, really watched the first four seasons a lot. I mean, a lot. Those first four, it's just a different sort of a younger sort of the accent's different. It's just sort of like those first four seasons. I mean, I went into David's office one time during pre-production and like showed, like, I had a family tree. I had a mob family tree. I had a timeline. Like, I had, like, I just wanted to be able to know kind of the ins and outs of the whole world. And again, that's because I became a super fan before we had started filming. I reintroduced myself to Billy when I first saw him in makeup. I didn't know it was Billy.
This is this very special SiriusXM Town Hall with the producer, writer, and stars of The Many Saints of Newark, a prequel to The Sopranos that is going to be in theaters and on HBO Max tomorrow, here with David Chase, Michael Gandolfini, Leslie Odom Jr., Alessandro Nivola. David, we were just talking about some of the characters who play younger, some of the actors who play younger versions of these iconic characters. Vera Farmiga as Livia, Tony's mom. We've got Corey Stoll, so chilling as Uncle Junior, a young Uncle Junior. Billy Magnuson playing a young Paulie Walnuts. How difficult, David, was it to get that right. Whereas, you know, Alessandro said, these are not Saturday Night Live impressions of these characters. They are, you definitely recognize them. There's definitely humor to it, but there's also, they are also real original performances.
Well, this is going to seem strange, but it wasn't difficult at all. We didn't even hold auditions for those roles, as far as I can remember. We sat around and talked about it, and someone would say a name, and usually we'd go, oh yeah, perfect, based on their track record thus far. I don't remember reading other Uncle Juniors or any other Silvios. John Magaro, I'd worked with before, and we were friends, and he came to me with the idea about the bald head and the toupee and all that. I took care of that.
You play Silvio, by the way.
Silvio, yeah. it wasn't difficult. I guess we were extremely lucky. I mean, I remember when the name Vera Farmiga came up, there was like not even any discussion. Everybody just went, oh yeah, okay, yeah, let's make the offer. So I've never done that before in my life.
David, there are some, you know, like Easter eggs for nerds like myself that nerd out when that would happen within the Many Saints of Newark, but also it's very much an open film for people to enjoy if this might be an entry point to get into The Sopranos. But how much did you either have to hold back or say to yourself, oh, I have a scene with like a duck in the backwards. No, that's too on the nose. David, delete that. I'm not doing that. I'm not going to pander to this, you know, yeah. But I want to have, for example, like we get to see the origin of the beehive, the bouffant shooting, for example. I mean, there's really amazing moments that we get, but nothing heavy handed, which I think is obviously to your name. But
well, I'm sure there's people who disagree with you about the heavy handed part of it. You know, the thing that was interesting was, well, the movie still hasn't come out. Well, it came out in England, but it hasn't come out here in the United States. And for months leading up to today, people were complaining about it or praising it without seeing it.
Oh.
People would say, oh, I guess they're going to put that stupid thing about varsity athlete in there. We have to go through that again. Like we've been boring them to death with it, you know, making them watch that horrible stuff. And other people saying, God, I hope they put that varsity athlete thing in there. It's going to be so funny. It was really something to watch that happening. Everybody, I guess, had a kind of a, not an ownership position, but they felt very close to it. And they kind of knew what they wanted and hoped that they got it. And we saw, we went to a premiere last week, and there were lines of dialogue where the audience, 2,000 people in the theater, the audience knew the scene would be running. And the audience would, someone would had set up a line. You cut to the person who's going to say the famous line, and the person starts to get an expression on his or her face, and they would start to laugh already before the line came out, was uttered, and they'd laugh so loud you didn't hear the line. So somehow or other, we were in contact with some higher order that got the right people into the right roles. Because we, like I said, we didn't try people out.
Leslie, I think that there are a lot of conflicts because this is, you know, after all, the Many Saints of Newark. But I would say the central conflict is between, you know, your character, Harold, and Dickie. And can you tell me a little bit, just to give people a sense of what goes on in the movie without giving too much away, because David Chase would reach through the Zoom and strangle me if I did.
You and me both.
Yeah. So I'm going to lay this on you. Tell me about their relationship.
They always get you to do the dirt. What was the nasty work?
That's right. You know, here we go. It follows me in real life too. I think of them a lot like, fraternal twins, or, you know, brothers in some way, like, and the resentment that can build, inside a marginalized person. You know, if ever you felt like, you know, but for the color of my skin, or but for my my disability, or my gender, my sexual orientation, my socioeconomic status, where would I be? You know, if not for this prejudice, if not for this demerit, you know, that I got at the starting gate. I think, you know, that breeds resentment in Harold, as it does in a lot of people. And eventually, you know, like a good tragedy, you know, these two are kind of set on a collision course at the top of this film that we can't, that can't be avoided. In many ways, the fires and the riots give birth to the conflict and the action in our story. You know, it's the fire also raging in these characters. So that's what it is. You know, I think that these guys love each other a lot, and it's a thin line between love and hate.
Michael, I know you mentioned that, you know, obviously you watched the show later, which makes sense. There's such an emotional connection to it. But I also know that you did spend time on the set when you were very, very young. And I'm just curious what your concept was of The Sopranos when you were a little boy. Like, I assume you were seeing, you know, like Sunday family dinner being filmed, not anything that made you probably even understand what you were dealing with probably as a kid.
Yeah. You know, I mean, my concept of The Sopranos was, I didn't really have one. I was born when they were filming the first season. So there was no understanding that this was not normal. You know, I mean, that's one of the gifts of watching the show, is I got to meet Tony Soprano, the character I was going to play. Like, I didn't know, you know, I would, you know, run around and eat some food and talk to some people. And I just remember going to the makeup trailer and asking for like a black eye because I thought it was funny. And I had a little toy box, but, you know, that's about it. I didn't really spend much time there. I mean, my dad didn't want me to, and at the end of the day, it was a job my dad did. Like, if, you know, my dad was a contractor, I wouldn't really want to go to the house that he was building. But I do remember loving it. I remember a lot of my friends going to see my dad shoot anything. I even remember, like, on Not Fade Away, which David directed, I went to set and I brought a friend, and my friend was like, you just sit around all day. And I loved it. Like, I always did have I did want to be on set always, which was, you know, different than, I guess, the story of a lot of my friends who had parents who were actors. But, you know, The Sopranos, I truly didn't even know what it was about. Until I was probably like 15. I just, you know, I had no sort of, I just didn't know.
Yeah, there's this, I read a lot about that. Michael spent his childhood on the set. I never remember him there. I mean, I guess people picture him sitting there in Video Village, nodding. And
co-directing.
Exactly.
That didn't happen.
Uh-uh.
He was just a kid.
Yeah, when I was there rarely, I would be in my dad's trailer too, doing like homework or whatever. I wasn't really, because I would screw up the shot too, you know, like, it's just not a place really for kids. Not only content, just it's a job people are doing.
True.
Michael, how did your dad feel once the show was over and he went on to do so many other things? How did he feel about being so known as Tony Soprano? Because actors always have mixed feelings about those things, and I just wonder what his what his feeling about it, or did you ever even talk about that?
I mean, no, but I think me and David could both agree that he didn't love it. I think he was nervous about it as an actor. I think he wanted, you know, he was so different and sort of sensitive in many ways and didn't want people to think he was this, you know, gangster. But I mean, I can't speak for my dad, but I think deep down inside he had a lot of pride and was proud of what everyone did on that show. I actually know he was really proud of it, but you know, he didn't want to say that. I think he just wanted to worry that he was always going to be Tony Soprano. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, David might know more. I didn't talk to him about it. He was just my goofy kind of chubby dad at the end of the day.
There was one really amazing musical cue that I just took note of during the Many Saints of Newark, and that was during the actual kind of sequence of the riots, which David, I believe, is a Gil Scott-Heron track. Was that a track that you had in mind to use, or was there any? I mean, it's a really "Me and the Devil," I believe, is a song that you use in it. Which is really kind of a spoken word track. Was that something that you had planned on using, or did it just kind of fit perfectly with that sequence?
No, I hadn't planned on using it. That record came out in like 2010 or 11, and it's a great record. And I remember thinking, oh, I got to use this someday. Someday I'm going to use this. And I was making a movie at that time called Not Fade Away, which was about white rock and roll. White rock and roll based on black antecedents, Lead Belly and people like that. And it didn't have a place in that movie. But I always played it just for my own enjoyment. And then strangely enough, I didn't think of it for this movie. And then we were, as I see it, running into trouble in the editing. Things just weren't happening the way I had hoped they would. And that riot sequence, I thought, it wasn't Me and the Devil. It's called The Vulture.
Oh, The Vulture. Sorry.
I thought, wow, that thing. Well, one of those songs, we thought about putting Me and the Devil in the cemetery scene, which we didn't do, thankfully. And Gil Scott, you know, Gil Scott-Heron's in there also from The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. That was the brainchild of Susan Jacobs, our music supervisor, who was really great. So he's in there once already. And then as we were coming toward the end of the process, I remembered The Vulture, and I thought, wow, that would be. And you put it down, you put the song down there, and you play, you sync it up with the film, and lo and behold, he starts talking about babies being taken from their mama, having grief beyond compare, and the picture happens to be a woman hugging her teenage son who's just been shot down by the police. Those kind of things happen all the time with needle drops. And it's the greatest. I mean, it just was an accident. I mean, I knew that song would work there. The rhythm, and it was very, very suspenseful, and you knew something bad was coming. But I didn't know that those two things would line up just that way.
Yeah, it's a powerful moment.
David, just one last question. You mentioned earlier, even now it seems like you're sometimes surprised at the incredible investment and the, you know, sort of obsession over The Sopranos, like the debate over the finale, the people anticipating lines. Do all of those things, when you read the stuff, does it satisfy you? Does it frustrate you? What's your feeling over the fans' ownership of this show that you created?
My feeling is, We have the best fan base on earth. Some of it is like bitching and complaining and wheedling, but even that comes from a good place, I believe. It's because they care about what they're seeing. And that there's enough there in the show to start them talking about things rather than just like the show ends, they go up and go off and, you know, take a pee and then come back to what's on next. Do I sometimes say, oh, that's so stupid, or they missed the point completely? Of course. But the fact that most of the time they don't. And that's very gratifying. And just the amount of fervor at the premiere in New York was, I'm sure my friends who were there will agree, it was totally unexpected, the amount of furor and joy there was for this story about sociopathic guys. Yeah.
We will leave it there. The Many Saints of Newark is out tomorrow. It is going to be in theaters. It is going to be on HBO Max. The writer, producer, kingpin of The Many Saints of Newark, David Chase, thank you very much. Michael Gandolfini, congratulations on a performance that people are going to be talking about for a long time. Alessandro Nivola, I hope that we see more. I hope there are more prequels/sequels where we see more of Dickie. And same with Harold McBrayer, Leslie Odom Jr.
Bread.
It is great to see you again. Not giving anything away.
When he was 12. You know, like we've done Tony, we'll now do Dickie when he was 12.
Ooh.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That would be amazing.
William Ludwig can take over.
Yeah. Generational trauma forever. Yeah, I would love that.
The Many Saints of Newark out tomorrow in theaters and on HBO Max. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
This has been the Jess Cagle Podcast with Julia Cunningham, a SiriusXM production. Hear new episodes every Tuesday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.